is The Liminalist, the podcast between. This is Jason Horsley at horticulture.com talking to William Ray.
That's right. Yeah, I read your article, the long version. Wow, that's some detailed research. Good for you, man.
Thanks. Yeah, I got stuck in. There's something very compelling about the whole subject, as far as like an acid test of what's going on in our society at this time, I think.
Sure.
So I noticed that we started, by the way, I just start running.
Sure.
I noticed that your Twitter account is gone.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, what happened there? Tell us about it.
Well, what it was is I'm a sort of traditional leftist who's been pissed off with the whole identity politics and the rest of it, yeah? So about 6-8 months ago, I really ran face first into the whole transgender issue on Twitter because of women in England who were reacting to changes in the Gender Recognition Act there. And as you say, it's a compelling issue and you kind of fall down the rabbit hole. So because of what I saw going on there, I wrote an article about internet censorship. Because one of the issues that the trans activists are pushing is this idea of dead naming, the idea that I don't, as a journalist, have the right to list former names, alias, you know, also known as, basically.
What is that? I don't think I've heard about that.
What, dead naming? Oh, Lord.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is the idea that once a person transitions, that to in any way publicly use their former name is some sort of hate speech, basically. So this fellow on the West Coast, Jonathan Yaniv, you're aware of him, I guess?
No, I don't think I am.
Oh, wow. You are really about to go down the rabbit hole. So there's a gentleman in, I believe, Langley, BC. Under BC law, you can now self-identify as a woman.
Without any changes.
Yeah, exactly. You don't need a doctor's note. You don't need shit.
Wow.
And it's about to become that way in Nova Scotia. And this is the way it's going across Canada. What this means practically is that this person now has access to all female spaces.
Mm-hmm.
Change room, shower room. Girl Guides Canada now says that female identifying boys can shower with the girls.
Wow.
And again, this is just identification. This is no, they don't have to, yeah, there's no change. These are biological males, yeah. So this fellow, Jonathan Yaniv, he's about a 30-year-old, some kind of tech guy. He's in the tech industry, which is interesting.
Yeah.
He self-identifies as a woman. He calls himself on Facebook. He still uses both names, Jonathan Jessica Yaniv. So this guy launched suits under the BC Human Rights Tribunal against, I believe it is, 16 different women. Now, what he would do is he phoned all these women's, they do women's Brazilian waxes, basically, where they wax your genital area. Right. So he phoned a bunch of women who provide this service. Now, Brazilian wax is something a woman gets. There's another name for it if a man gets it. It's a different service provided by a different person. So he phoned and tried to make appointments to have these Brazilian waxes done. And of course these women were like, because this guy, he's a man. He doesn't take hormones or doesn't seem to, he just puts on lipstick. So he, of course they said, no, you know, like I don't provide this service to men. And, but because the gender, because he proclaims he's a woman, he can now take these women to the Human Rights Tribunal. Right, because they're interfering with his human right to live like a woman. Now it's obvious that this was a setup. Now he's going after money in all these cases. In pretty much all these cases, these are women who are, you know, doing this out of their house, their single mother, you know, they're just trying to make a little money. Right? Not exactly. So people got pissed off about this. And now under all 16 of these suits, he was simply named as J.Y., Jonathan, you know, instead of his name, because to protect him, because he's in a protected class. And so this enraged so many women that they doxed him out. They figured out who he was. Then after that, they started looking through his social media and these sort of things. And they found a bunch of disturbing as shit chat logs where he talks about being in women's change rooms, often with minor children. And he's talking about things like, oh, there aren't as much tits as I thought I'd see. And is it okay if I go bond with a 10-year-old about menstruation issues? Something about tampon strings hanging out of women. Like it's, you know, 10 years ago, there would have been no question. Someone turned this over to the RCMP, they'd have been at his house.
Yeah.
But now, oh no, it's a trans woman discovering herself.
Right.
So what had been happening over, especially this case, this is what a feminist writer called Megan Murphy got kicked off Twitter for.
Right.
Was simply using his name, using Jonathan Yaniv, referring to him as Jonathan Yaniv. So I wrote an article, and it was about this issue, but I was using it as an example of the fact that we've turned over the public space to these large multinational corporations. Right? Men used to go to barber shops, talk over the fence, coffee shops, that sort of thing. You know, men and women, not just men there, but you know what I mean. Those public spaces are gone. Right? Even when you're in one of them, what do you see? You see a couple of dozen people with their face in a phone. So the only places that we actually have a public discourse about the issues of the day is not a free space. It's not owned by us. And these corporations can do whatever they want. Twitter itself has decided that this dead naming goes against its rules. And in fact, most anything that criticizes anything to do with transgender ideology, they've decided it breaks their community standards and you're gone. So when you look at Twitter, it looks like the whole world is on board with this and everyone agrees.
Right.
Yeah. So I was, the article itself was taken down by Medium, the online, you know what Medium is.
Yeah, I didn't know they were doing it too, but yeah.
Yeah, they took it down. I actually, one of the things that did prompt me to write it is I'd written an earlier article on WordPress called Stand for Women, in which I had dead named a couple of transgender activists. And instead of taking the blog down, which is, this was even creepier to me, they had gone into it and edited out the names and then sent me an email afterwards saying, hey, we just edited your blog.
Oh, they admitted to it at least.
Oh, yeah. Well, I wouldn't have known, right? They sent me an email, but now I got to think, well, fuck, do I have to check everything I've ever written? What, you know, what else might they not agree with, you know? So that prompted me to write an article about the issue. That article was taken down by Medium. And then about 2 hours later, my Twitter account was suspended. I also had a completely separate Twitter account from a separate email that was for a film. My partner and I made a full-length documentary film. And it was suspended. Boom. Because I guess, you know, they might, I guess by looking at the pattern of tweets, they could tell that it was owned by me, I guess.
And the film wasn't anything to do with this subject matter?
No, the film was about resource extraction, comparing Alberta to Northern Quebec. It was an environmental film.
Right. So pretty kosher within this particular minefield. There was no reason that would have been targeted. except
No,
by
no, no.
association.
Again, the only reason I can see is that, they would have associated with me.
You've been blacklisted. And how many followers did you have on Twitter?
Oh, not that many. I mean, I had about 1,500.
Right, it's about how many I have. So it seems as though somebody has decided that your voice needs to be neutralized, not based more than just on what you're saying, because there's many people tweeting about these sorts of things. I've certainly been writing about for some time. And so far, I haven't been, as far as I know, I might have been, edited. My pieces could have been, that's possible. I did have something with WordPress recently, but I think it was my mistake. But it did make me wonder if they were doing stuff. But yeah, I'm curious about this, like, who gets targeted and why?
Well, in this, excuse me. In this instance, it seems to have to do with this individual. But the thing is, he's connected to the tech industry. I can send you all this stuff. I'll send you the log of his tweets, man. You'll want to go get a shotgun, I
I
swear to
did.
God.
Now that you've described the whole thing, I'm familiar with it from my wife. I just didn't remember the name. So yeah, I'm aware of that
Right.
curve. Yeah.
So this particular guy, for whatever reason, he seems to have a connection with especially Twitter. And for whatever reason, anybody that crosses this guy, boom,
Okay, so
right?
you're saying there's nothing on, as far as you know, there's nothing on Twitter at this point that goes against him.
They've certainly done a hell of a job. They've nuked WordPress also completely took down a blog called Gender Trender
Yeah, I heard
or
about that.
Gender. Yeah, they completely took that thing down. So it's across the board, and it's kind of terrifying because it's like I've been looking into the issue. Like this thing started around 2012, 2013 with highly financed charities either being opened or existing LGBT charities kind of being taken over, and this thing was hugely funded and managed to get almost simultaneous legislation across the Anglosphere, if you will, Australia, UK, Canada, England, US, that very, very cleverly went into human rights type legislation and changed the wording in such a way to protect a class that really doesn't really exist. If you catch my meaning, it's not, I don't know. This the science behind the whole transgender thing is quite sketchy. I mean, this all comes out of psychology, psychiatry, and mostly psychology. And that's an arts degree. There are no physiochemical indicators for any of this.
Right. And as far as it coming out as psychology, it's a pathology. I mean, there isn't really a psychological
It
basis for
was
how it's.
pathology.
Yeah. So now it's being
It
pushed in.
was pathology up until the last edition of the DSM. Okay, the DSM-5. Before that was the DSM-4. It's a, oh bloody hell, what does it stand for? Statistical. It's what they use. It's what
Yeah,
psychiatrists,
the
psychologists.
diagnostical statistical
Yeah,
manual,
something
something like that.
diagnostic statistical something.
Yeah.
So there was a hugely funded political legal push to change this particular thing, and it is always highly politicized, and there's a lot of money involved. This is a billions and billion dollar a year industry, the psychiatric industry, based on not a lot of objective knowledge. A lot of it is quite subjective. So whatever this book says is a condition, this gets funding, this gets treatment. You know what I mean? So there was a very concerted push to change it from gender disorder, gender identity disorder, to gender identity dysphoria, and to change the best practices. And this was done in a very coordinated way across multiple countries, to change best practices to immediately confirm. As soon as some kid says, yeah, I feel like a girl, okay, boom, you are. You're transgender. Let's get the hormone blockers. Let's go.
Mm-hmm. And even before that,
in Canada, they're trying to bring legislation in under the guise of anti-conversion therapy, like that horrible shit for gay people.
Yeah.
Where they try and make a gay guy straight. But what this would apply to is actual recognized psychiatric treatment that tries to make someone comfortable with the body they're born in. This would now be characterized as conversion therapy.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, it's dangerous as shit. They're shoving this into the school system. And I mean, you know, this Soji 123 that you have there in BC. This is messed up. I mean, that's what that meeting was about at the Legion. They just want to talk about, because this goes way beyond gender stuff. They're talking about anal sex in grade 3.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they are presenting very young children with something that's not scientifically supportable. They are saying that young children have the power to make decisions about who they fundamentally are. I mean, you don't know what you are when you're a little kid.
Mm-hmm.
I often liken it to the fact that, you know, when I was in grade 1, 2, 3, you know, I thought I was a pirate. I was pretty sure I was a pirate. You know, I had little pirate hats and everything else. I'm pretty fucking glad nobody poked my eye out to confirm my fucking identity. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And that's essentially what's happening here.
Yeah.
You know, so, yeah.
Well, there's a fundamental, I mean, this whole thing is rife with contradictions, as I'm sure you're aware. I mean, you can't avoid bumping into a contradiction, you know, just every step of the way with these agendas and these ideologies. But specifically talking about the DSM, there's this fundamental contradiction there, which is that they have to categorize gender dysphoria as something that can be diagnosed in order that people can get the treatment, right?
But yeah, because they sure don't want to pay for the
exactly right, so you can get it on insurance and all the rest of it. But it's not permissible to talk about it as any kind of pathology or any kind of problem,
right? And that you're right, that's a fundamental contradiction that has not been addressed by the medical community. Because the guise of human rights, the legislation that they put this under, I talked to her name will come to me in a second, she's a doctor in the United Kingdom who is speaking out on this issue, and she has talked about her colleagues who, they get this kid come in, the parents come in with a kid, oh, my kid's transgender, kid's like, yeah, I'm a little girl, the doctor's like, well, let's talk about this, they can lose their license.
Yeah.
Right? Because best practices, which again were put in under the radar by these very well-financed charity groups. In BC, it's ARC. Out in Ontario, it's EGAL. Right? And there's been a lot of, like with EGAL, here's a fun story for you.
Yeah.
Okay, so EGAL was a group that was formed to promote gay marriage. God bless them. I mean, why shouldn't they be miserable too? Yeah. So they did an excellent job of this. They were a grassroots type thing. They were supported mostly through donations. They never had a huge budget, but they were very creative with it. And I've interviewed someone from there. I talked to someone from there. So they said after, you know, what was it, 2010 when the gay marriage went through?
Don't remember.
Something like that. But after, you know, they had won that fight, this person told me they were about to close the doors. That was it. They didn't, you know, because obviously they won the issue, so they're not getting that grassroots funding. Suddenly, they get a new director, and suddenly, Government of Ontario money starts to rain down on them from zero to a little over $1 million in 1 year.
Mm-hmm.
Then, okay, so this starts right around the 213 mark, where this seems to start across the board. So over the next number of years, the Ontario government's directly giving them millions of dollars. Starting in 2014, 2015, and through 2016, millions of dollars are going out the door from EGAL to the federal Liberal Party. So this came from the Wynn government, who the ones that brought in the initial gender legislation in Canada with their Ontario Human Rights Board changes, gives the money to this group. This group then gives that cash to the federal Liberals, which is, it sounds close to election fraud. And when the federal Liberals are elected, one of their first acts is to take a copy, paste version of the Ontario Human Rights changes and bring it federal. And I mean, I don't have to tell you, like, the Trudeau government has been, yeah, just outrageously loud about this issue.
So was Bill C-16 one of the results of this then?
Exactly. Well, that is copy paste of the Ontario legislation that was brought in, I believe, in 2014-15. Same time as the controversial Ontario curriculum, which is very much like your SOGI 1-2-3. And I mean, parents in Canada, they don't object to their kids being taught stranger danger. They don't object to their kids being taught tolerance. What they object to is their kids being taught about sexual acts in grade four, because somehow this is necessary to promote transgender tolerance. You know, and I mean, grade three, four. Yeah, anyway, I mean, it's age inappropriate. It's been brought in Ontario, and I'm not even kidding you, the guy that designed the curriculum ended up going to jail for pedophilia.
Right. So let's linger on that for a moment, because that's obviously a critical detail. What's this guy's name?
Former Ontario Deputy Minister of Education, Benjamin Levin.
Okay. And how instrumental was he in C-16?
Well, no, he was instrumental in the curriculum in Ontario.
The forerunner to C-16.
Well, I guess, I mean, they're related. That's the thing, is it's across the bloody board. Yeah. I mean, the education system, these things, and in on BC and Ontario, these groups like EGAL or ARC, they design the curriculum and then give it to the teachers' union, and that's it. Right? That's not the normal way curricula is designed for schools. Yeah, and so you had these things like Bill C-16 going through the human rights legislation at the exact same time you've got SOGI 1-2-3 and the rest of it slamming into the school system. And if you dare complain, you're a homophobe. I mean, in Alberta, do you know what's going on in Alberta?
Not about this, no.
Okay, so in Alberta, as part of this whole program with the curriculum and everything, they have brought in these things they call gay straight alliances. So this is a group in high schools, and the law around this says that if your kid joins this, the school not only is not to inform you of this, but they are actually supposed to lie to you about it if you ask. There's a court challenge right now, very interesting. You should definitely look this up. The court challenge has united Christians, Muslims, Hasidic Jews, and I'm missing one, Sikhs, in suing the Alberta government to say, hey, you can't do this. You can't hide things about our children from us. You cannot presume that we are going to abuse our children. And during the course of this case in the last couple of weeks, it came out that high school kids, minor children, have been taken off-site, off-school property by these so-called GSA counselors who are not employed by the Department of Education. There is little or no screening that anyone can find for these people. They were taken out of school and brought to a gay straight alliance conference Because that's what high school's for.
Right.
I mean, I went to high school in Alberta in the mid-80s, okay, in Edmonton, right? Not exactly world-renowned for, let's say, gentle spirit, yeah? But I went to high school in Alberta in the mid-80s. We had openly gay people at my school. Nobody gave a shit.
Mm-hmm.
Boy George was top in the charts. RuPaul was the most popular MTV VJ. Nobody cared. But they are presenting this as if without these gay straight alliances, gay kids are going to face this horrible repression. They're going to be beaten daily. There's zero statistics to back it up.
Right.
They constantly, when they shove this stuff through, they constantly talk about the huge risk of suicide of transgender young people if they're not confirmed. A doctor in England actually went through the statistics in a 10-year period. There were zero suicides they could attribute to that. I suspect the it's about the same here.
Well, it's a meaningless demographic anyway, because you can't attribute causality, as in people are more prone to suicide are also more prone to transitioning and gender. Well, you
well,
can't say which
it.
Is causing which anyway.
Right. Well, exactly. Do you know about the Swedish study?
I think so. That massive one from some years back. Yeah.
Yeah. The only long-term study of these people, and it says that they have 10 times the comorbidity rate for other, you know, I mean, if you believe somehow you were born in the wrong body, it's possible you might have some other odd, you know, beliefs, I suppose.
Well, yeah, that it might actually be nested in a whole complex, a psychological complex of whatever,
well, exactly.
You know, ramifications.
Exactly. But doctors are completely discouraged from any exploration of any of that. You're just supposed to confirm the person and move on.
To confirm the existence of a gender self that's antithetical to biology, which itself is a metaphysical endeavor, really. Like, what is this self that's being posited? Like, it would be a massive breakthrough of science, wouldn't it? That we discovered.
Well, it would. It certainly would. And we haven't made it. You were talking about contradictions. I mean, one of the base contradictions here is, on the one hand, this group of people says gender is a social construct, right? Yeah. Just a construct. It's a reflection of the patriarchy and capitalism and all that. But if I'm the other gender, I need to have surgery.
Yeah.
And I need to have access to the other sex's spaces. Well, why, if it's a social construct, why is it? I mean, I saw a good, one of the ladies in England had an excellent meme. It was like a, you know, a huge soap bubble. And it said, you know, transgender ideology. And the next frame was one of these high speed motion captures of the bubble, the soap bubble bursting. Hmm. Right. And it said, transgender ideology under gentle questioning. And that's why the absolute repression of any questioning has to be pursued by them.
Hmm.
I mean, if we had, this is a discussion. This is affecting children. It's affecting women's rights. If we were to have this discussion, or if they were to put this discussion honestly on the CBC National, oh boy.
Breathing out, I don't know what it's all about. I'm feeling here, I'm feeling there, I'm feeling everywhere. Now that you're broke, who's gonna fix you up? Fix you up. You've got a kidney on a fork. You've got a mouth that covers the size of New York. You've got a donkey on a string, but it's not leading you to anything. that you broke. Who's gonna fix you up? Fix you up. Look in your eyes. Look in your eyes. Well, they sell you this stuff with the money that you never had. Then they want it all back. They make you redundant and blame you for being a slacker, while a financial backer is taking a call with a strawberry mousse. Now that you're broke, fix you up. You've got a mountain made of green, but nothing's ever gonna be enough for me. I'm breathing air, I'm breathing dust, I'm breathing anything that I can trust. Now that you broke, who's gonna fix you up? Fix you up. Fix you up. What are we
I was just saying, it seems like it's only a matter of time. It's a question of how long. I mean, I can't believe it hasn't exploded already. But we're talking about the GSA, the Gay Straight Alliance, this thing, and even in SOGI, sexual orientation, gender identification. So far, the whole propaganda program is about, you could say, the gender identification thing coattailing on the homosexual rights and so on, because they've, you know, they've already established that as a human rights issue and so on. So now they want the gender thing to coattail on that, but they're actually contradictory in themselves, because gender identification cancels out sexual orientation. As in, if you've got a boy who's acting feminine or is attracted to other boys, the new ideology negates their identification as homosexual by affirming their identification as a woman, or pushing them to identify as a woman. So it's actually, you could say, it's an anti-homosexual drive, the gender thing. I mean,
that's certainly the opinion very loudly of a lot of lesbian groups.
Yeah. Yeah, they're the sort of canaries in the coal mine there, aren't they?
Well, I suppose, because they got literally these clowns right in their lap, you know, demanding that they, you know, break the cotton ceiling. Well, you know, you have to ignore the fact that I have a penis and I look like a man. I'm a woman, because I told you.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the only, like, it's so frustrating, the literal stupidity.
Yeah.
The obvious contradiction, the obvious problems are being ignored. And I think beyond this specific issue, I think it's also important to note, how would I say, as a wedge issue, if this can be forced down our fucking throats, if we can be forced to reject objective reality, to reject common sense, and accept a doctrine in its place, that's quite the fucking precedent, boy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're all walking into Nuremberg right after that, aren't we?
Well, it seems more further advanced than anything. I mean, anything we can refer back to historically. Sure, we can refer back to you know, atrocities and that, but in terms of actual, mind control, let's say, systematized large-scale mind control, to use a bit of a loaded term, but really, you know, brainwashing is what it is. I can't think of anything that's equivalent to it. I mean, it just boggles my mind that people would go along with this. And I wonder, you know, if we're even meant to go along with it, or for how long. Like you talked in your conversation with Benjamin Boyce about how this is pushing many of us into much more conservative affiliations than we would ever have dreamed of assuming. Sure. As the only possible alternative, and it just seems more and more sane. Like the most sane people currently are the conservative Christians, you know. And how did it get?
Who would have thought that, huh?
So, the whole divide and conquer thing, which you write about in your recent piece, and you had experience of it in Croatia. I think that's an area to really look into. I was thinking just today while you were talking, you know, back at Charlie Manson, for example, he had this crazed idea about creating a war between the blacks and the whites. And currently what it looks like is being generated by all of these movements is a war between the male and female. I mean, they're even trying to eradicate the word woman quite successfully, actually. In the UK now, I was just reading about it, you can't use the word woman at all. You've got to use cervix-owning human or something like that, depending on the context, right? So, and as you're pointing out, the more and more of the resistance is coming from women here. But anyway, whoever's being divided to conquer, but I mean, that's the most basic division. If you can drive a wedge between the sexes, that's the most basic biological division, even more basic than black and white, right?
Well, I think you got a bit of a perfect storm here, I think, maybe. And it's, you know, I'm not, as I mentioned when I talked to Benjamin, you know, I certainly have no hard proof to indicate it. But, if you just look at who really benefits from all of this, not just the trans thing, but the whole identity politics thing, which this is intrinsically a part of. On the one hand, this all comes out of a neo-Marxist revolutionary type philosophies from the universities, from conflict studies. All of it originates from conflict studies. They originate from Marxism. Judith Butler in 1991 lays out a plan in her problem gender troubles book. It's right there. She says, and if you give me a sec, I can quote here, I think. But basically, this is a political ideology that's meant to, that is meant to disrupt society. I mean, that's the whole, Marxist type thing. You got to disrupt society. Mm-hmm. So this is meant to, because she equates. So strangely enough, she went to a prep school, another very rich woman, much like Peggy McIntosh. She went to a prep school called Bennington.
Oh yeah.
Comes from, you know, sort of the 1%. Bennington was highlighted in 1951 by the US State Department for its unique educational approach as a model for the Allied rebuilding of German society after World War I. So just a footnote. That was her prep school. And she would have been going there not long after. So what she says, as an effort to think through the possibility of subverting and displacing these naturalized and rarefied notions of gender that support masculine hegemony, and the heterosexist power to make gender trouble, not through the strategies that figure a utopian beyond, but through the mobilization, subversion, confusion, and proliferation of precisely those constitutive categories that seek to keep gender in its place by posturing as the functional illusions of identity. So again, let's go through that. Subversion, confusion, proliferation.
Mm-hmm.
Sounds like they're sticking with the plan.
When does that date back to?
1991. And this is the woman who actually invented what's strangely called gender studies, although they don't spend a whole lot of time actually studying gender per se.
Well, they couldn't really, because gender doesn't exist. So it's
right.
A bit of an obstacle there. Yeah.
Well, exactly. So this is, it is a revolutionary active ideology.
Right.
And, he lays it out right there. I would highly recommend this book if you want to get a grasp of what's going on. What that means, a lot of this is not about the health of any of these individual people. You know? Studies show, and I mean, it seems to be reality, these people suffer from a variety of mental health issues. And, you know, for political reasons, they're being sold a bill of goods in a way.
Yeah, political and corporate, of course, is a massive profit motive as well. But I would agree that underneath that, and even more deep, is even deeper is the...
Well, that's why I say it's the perfect storm, because you've got the radical left and the hard, you know, the actual people in charge. The same thing is in both their interests. Mm-hmm. And I try and get across to some of these wokenauts out there that, okay, if this is some actual revolutionary ideology that's going to change society, why is it being backed by major corporations?
Mm-hmm.
Why is it being across the board parroted by the mainstream media? Why?
Mm-hmm. And nationwide, I mean, national leaders and governments. And yeah, it's as establishment exactly. as it gets.
Exactly. So if this is actually some, you know, going to end capitalism, end the patriarchy or the heteriarchy or hegemony, whatever the hell, why is it being sold to you by the people in charge? You know, but the thing is that, and many writers have mentioned this, the whole package is like a religion. These people act like religious people. You know, there's a limit to reasoned argument with these guys. And they've got a bunch of go-tos. You're right wing. You lack humanity. You lack empathy. You're racist. You're a transphobe, whatever the hell that means.
Yeah. Well, because there's different levels here, it makes it confusing because one is never quite sure if one is talking to, you know, what kind of level of awareness or ideological rationale one is being confronted with. Because what you're suggesting there, and I would agree, and I can give you some of my own research to refer to on this, in terms of it being a long-term social engineering strategy to destabilize society, you've got, at that level, you've got people who don't really believe in the ideologies that they're propagating except as means to an end, but that the part of the means is to possess another, you know, a lower level of the collective with those beliefs, so that then they will carry them into society and act them out with this religious zeal. But kind of ironically, or again, I suppose the perfect storm, that the people who are possessed by these ideologies and really believe that this is radical progressive leftism and all the rest of it, they also want to destroy the patriarchy. So they also have this viewpoint that in order to create a better world, we need to tear down the present one. So there is an overlap there, even if I would say that the social engineering program, as far as I can tell, it's certainly not about creating a better world. It seems to be about creating a much more tightly controlled world. Yeah.
Well, depends on your point of view. Like I said, like revolutionary Marxist ideology, the idea is to stabilize society. So it's actually working very well. This and all the identity politics, white privilege, the whole bit is actually working perfect.
Right.
Because the idea is not that you believe what you're pushing.
The idea is that you provoke a reaction, right? You provoke the reaction in the population, and then you can, it's playbook Che Guevara stuff. You provoke the reaction from the other, and then you can point to it and use it as a recruiting tool. So you hit the population with hard identity politics. All white people suck. Anything white people have ever done sucks. Any group, when it's attacked, is going to react defensively. That's the nature of humans. Here in Canada, I don't know that we had, you know, that much of a modern white consciousness in my generation. We've always had a few dipshit skinheads kicking around. But this was never a huge political force here. But you look at the Yellow Vest movement here in Canada, unfortunately, so far, and a lot of it just seems to be this rage reaction against these, you know, being told that they're settler, white privileged pieces of crap. For a good half decade, solid.
Right.
So that's what that is their aim. Now, that also works beautifully for the right wing, right? Because, yeah, they're growing huge. Like, I was looking as sort of an unconventional metric at the different sort of social media identities, like, you know, Rabble.ca, right?
Who's that?
Rabble.ca?
Rabble.ca. Yeah, no, I don't know that.
Yeah, super, super left-wing publication. Used to have something like 100-some thousand followers, yeah?
Okay.
This thing's down to around 20. Things like Ontario Proud have like 400,000 members.
Right.
This Yellow Vest, 100,000 members in 40 hours.
Right.
And so, you know, I mean, you know, unless he strangles a baby on the steps of Parliament, I think Andrew Scheer is pretty much guaranteed 24 Sussex Drive next election. And yeah, for these now, the left wing side of it, these guys, you know, these are university guys. A lot of them never left universities. They sit around and talk about these theories. It might sound great in the back room, but when you actually shut that out into society, there's a whole shitload of unintended consequence because humans are fucking complex. And these ideas are simple, very simplistic. Black, white, good, bad. So they don't stand up to contact with the real world, and again causes a lot of unintended knockoff consequences. Trans rights sounds beautiful as theory, but when you put it into practice, well, look at that. Look what happens. It impacts on women's rights. It impacts on parents' rights. You know. So yeah, there's nothing good coming out of it for sure, and you know, whether it's you know, some actor trying to direct it, or whether it again is just a perfect storm. And the problem, I think, too, and something I have to keep reminding myself, is the sort of the generation outrage, the millennials here that we always pick up, right? These guys, if you really think about it, some of their first interactions with the fucking world was like 9/11, the invasion of Iraq. They grew up with beheading videos,
right?
So that anger, that absolute need for some kind of change, that's very valid. Unfortunately, this has been hijacked, you know, by this identity politics ideology, but it was sold to these kids in the universities, univoice, because you can't go on a university campus and have a different opinion. It was sold to them, you know, by authority figures as this is it, this is the way forward. Anybody who disagrees with you is part of the problem.
Right. Well, I mean, I think that this is something that can be mapped backward. I don't know. Are you familiar at all with the Fabian Society?
I've heard of it. No, you'd have to.
Yeah, well, it's pretty hard to give the condensed version, but I'll try. So the Fabian Society was started in the late 1800s, the same period that Marx was in London, right? So he wasn't involved with it, but it was partly intended as a way to make Marx accessible to the English people, let's say, and to the intelligentsia in England and even to the more common people. So George Bernard Shaw, that was one of his interests, was in Marx and Marxism and how to repackage it and reformulate it for new audiences. Whether or not he was working with Marx, there's no evidence to suggest that, just that they were both in the same place at the same time. And coincidentally, and I haven't really mapped these two on to each other, but the Uranian movement was also in the late 1800s, and that was a precursor to the transgender thing, because that Uranian thing was about the third sex. That was this idea that there were men who were also women. And so that also goes back to the same period, right? And the Fabian Society, they were massively influential. I mean, the scope of their influence is, you know, has yet to be determined, but it's certainly visible. They created the Labour Party, so you know the left, the whole left establishment in the UK can be sourced in the Fabian movement. But they also infiltrated all different levels of society in terms of the arts and medicine and the sciences, and specifically education. That was one of their primary focuses, and they had this idea of weaponized professors. It's kind of inseparable.
Oh, wow. From, this sounds very familiar.
Yeah. I was going to say it's inseparable, really, from intelligence operations. If you think about COINTELPRO and things like that, not that they were official or you know known to be an intelligence organization, the Fabian Society, but the way they operated. They call themselves permeators, and they're all you know rich. They're all ruling class people of great influence, and they. They had an ideology and an agenda, a long-term agenda.
It just seems to be the super rich leftists that do this stuff. The working class folk, not so much.
Right, no. And I found out about this because I grew up with a very rich leftist family. And in fact, my grandfather's a Fabian, okay. But I didn't know this. But I sort of saw a blueprint of this, which is the ruling class with a leftist progressive politics, who seemed to be, they were paying lip service to all of the right, correct ideologies, anti-racism, you know, homosexual rights, and so on. Actually, back then it was pedophile rights, so it was the pedophile information exchange back then, so that's also in the mix. But if you saw the results and you saw the way they lived, my family and the Fabians, it was actually all about serving the ruling class. It was all about pushing agendas that in the long term increased their advantage and also fragmented society. Basically, I mean, the family unit was considered the thing to target, the thing to destroy, right?
Well, it sounds like the blueprint.
Yeah, and it was just to finish that point, that one of the ways they were successful was via various corporations like the Ford Corporation, the Rand Corporation. They infiltrated the American education system. So John Taylor Gatto, I think his name is. He's written the underground history of American education, and he has a chapter about the Fabian Society, and how you can trace the way that the American education system was infiltrated and reconfigured during the, I guess, the early 1900s, can be traced back to the Fabian Society. So I think we're probably seeing, the visible manifest results. And the thing about Fabian, that their methodology, it comes from Fabius the Emperor, was incremental and very, very slow over a long period of time. So you can't notice the changes, like the lobster in the pot kind of thing. You just gradually the temperature's rising, and by the time you actually see, you know, that you're in a pot of boiling water, it's too late.
Well, it's Well, I mean, that certainly seems to be what's going on. And it is interesting that the people that have pushed this ideology or formulated it, like Peggy McIntosh, like Judith Butler, very much come from the ruling class. I did an essay for Quillette magazine on Peggy McIntosh. Are you aware who she is there?
I read the article, one about white privilege. No?
Oh, okay. Yeah, so I mean, you know, like she literally comes from American aristocracy.
Right.
You know, and same thing with Butler. She comes out, you know, so, you know, their class interests definitely are actually served by the division and the atomization of the left into ever increasingly smaller interest groups. And
And that, I mean, that's
a all up in society.
Sorry, say that again. You cut out.
I'll have to read up on the Fabian Society. Thanks for that.
Yeah, I can send you some stuff if you like. I was thinking that the example you just came up is kind of a microcosm in many ways, because this woman is on the one hand, she's using her class privilege to propagate an idea of white privilege, which has the dual effect of deflecting awareness from her own, you know, manipulations and her own exploitations or what she's part of, and redirecting it to a whole other demographic, which is the target. And I want to bring it to your experience in Croatia, because you write about that in the same article. So you write about how identity politics, how it can be used as an ideological weapon in this way for creating division, and how it always seems to end up with the same result.
Well, it does. I mean, there isn't an example in human history of identity politics working out well. Yeah, it's usually a tool of political motivation. You know, whether it's the Nazi parties attacking the Jews as a convenient straw man, or the situation in Croatia where people had literally lived together in the same village all their life, gone to school together, intermarried, no problem. It took about less than 10 years for their political leaders to have them cutting each other's heads off. You know, all of these structures around us, the basic civility of our society, these are paper thin. People don't realize that. It doesn't take a lot for all of this to break down. And if you divide people enough, it starts to break.
Well, so it's two things going on, obviously a lot more than two, but two basic ones is if a community or a society that's being destabilized, that's losing stability, that already generates tension, anxiety, obviously, and tension. And then, I don't know if you're familiar at all with René Girard's work, but he writes about the whole of society and culture and how it centers around the scapegoat mechanism. At a certain, well, first of all, it's mimetic rivalry, right? So you have communities, you have any kind of collective, then people work together and they develop behaviors by imitation. That's basic to human behavior, like we imitate each other. And so part of this is we also imitate what other people want. So you see this with children, you get two kids, one toy, or no, a whole bunch of toys. One kid picks up one toy and suddenly the other kid wants the same toy that his friend has picked
up,
right? Just because of that, right?
Yeah.
So you got mimetic desire, and that leads to mimetic rivalry. So then what Girard says is that you need a scapegoat to bind the community together. So you could say that the divide and conquer thing plays on this, because once the community's been destabilized, then it creates a narrative, let's say, this identity politics, by which one group scapegoats the other, or both groups scapegoat each other. Right?
Well, I think there might be something interesting there. There certainly seems, and with the inclusion of social media in this ideology, there's a very quick problem-reaction-solution cycle in that there's a new boogeyman. Now, these kids, don't seem to know about foreign wars or anything else, but somebody says something inappropriate, does something they consider inappropriate, there's this, you know, huge social media mobbing, there's threats of boycott, there's this and that, and then they destroy that individual's career, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that's a, you know, it's kind of an intense quick cycle lap, but it satisfies all the what you're speaking of there, sort of the,
yeah.
Well, I mean, whoever's doing it, what needs to happen to me to move forward, the first thing is people, a lot of progressives have to start speaking up against this, have to start saying, you know what, this is not progressive politics. This is not the left wing. This is not, this is, yeah, like just pick apart this ideology, which is easy. Once you actually bring it out into the open, it's easy to rip apart.
It's easy to rip apart, but it's not easy to show those who are committed to it.
Oh, you got to forget that. No, I'm serious. Yeah. We could spend the next 100 years. These people, it's a dogmatic belief system.
Yeah.
These people believe in it. So there's, you know, not everybody, because a lot of people, it just comes out of their mouth because that's what's socially accepted. They may not, they may question it. They may not even believe in it. But, you know, to be in their peer group, this is what has to come out of their mind.
Yeah.
But the actual hardcore ideologues, you got to forget about it.
But how can you tell which is which?
I think within different social groups you can tell. But, I mean, all I'm saying is until this is pushed out of social movements, you're not going to have any social movements. We don't even have a peace movement. You can barely get a labor movement. Even the environmental movement suffers from all this. You just have to get these people out of progressive politics and have left-wing people stand up and say, no, we reject this. This is not the way.
Thank you.
So, because we have different backgrounds, and my problem here is that I can't find a time where progressive politics wasn't always geared towards this end. It seems as though, if I trace it back, progressive politics was never really anything but an instrument of the ruling class.
Oh, I see what you're saying. I can certainly think of instances in Canada where it hasn't been. Mm-hmm. I certainly don't have the level of knowledge and understanding of its roots in the English context. Here in Canada, our progressive politics is characterized probably the best by a guy named Tommy Douglas. Mm-hmm. And so he was a working class type of guy. And, you know, his point was simply that, you know, there's a political economic elite that rules us. And, you know, they create these two sort of different parties we can vote for, kind of Pepsi Coke. Hmm. But whichever one you vote for, his famous speech was, you know, black cats or white, it's all bad for mice. Mm-hmm. Right. And that whichever, you know, supposed side in the political spectrum we're picking, it's the same elite guiding it. So until we're willing to put people in power that are not from that elite, you know, and I mean, you can see, I mean, how many people in politics, their daddy was in it, they're, you know, they come from political families or they come from mercantile families. There's very few working class people ever get into politics in our current system.
Sure. Yeah.
But we're not talking about any of that in the left. We're talking about the cultural appropriateness of cafeteria fucking food.
Yes, but there's an overlap though, because it's a central to the left rhetoric. It is that we have to overthrow the oligarchy, and that it's the evil 1% and all that. That's part of the leftist rhetoric.
Well, not so much anymore, is it? You hardly ever hear that term anymore, actually. Like, one of the things, I use an example. So around 2011, 2012, now I was covering the student strike in Quebec, but across the planet, you had like the Occupy movement. They occupied 1,900 cities in the G20 countries. And we were communicating with each other. It was coordinated. That had never happened in human history. You know, the quick succession of 9/11, the bullshit wars in Iraq, the financial collapse had really broken a lot of people's, I don't know, whatever it is, investment in the system. And they were ready to say, hey, no, we need to fundamentally shake this up. Fast forward, you know, 7 years. What do you got? Nothing. Nobody's talking about the wealth gap. Nobody's talking about, I mean, geez, we're closer to nuclear war than we've been in my lifetime. Nobody's talking about that. Nobody's talking about the structural problems with our political system, lobbyists, yada, yada, yada. Nobody. You don't see it in the so-called alternative press. You don't see it.
Well, I agree. There's certainly, you know, very little deep analysis going on. But there's lots of talk about the patriarchy still and evil white men.
Yeah, but it's mostly in terms of white men, and this is, you know, the this comes out of the universities. This is this third wave racism, anti-racism stuff.
Sure.
It really sounds like racism. Excellent article about 5 days ago in the Atlantic by a black university professor in the States. He calls it virtue signaling won't save the world. And he talks about exactly that. Somehow this morphed into this just rhetorical hate spewing shit that is trying to put this all on the back of your average working class white person who probably is not racist. right, at all, has never done anything racist. A lot of this is based on the completely debunked, that preference test bullshit they came out with. You know what I mean?
The thing that Jordan Peterson was complaining about, right, with the racial profiling or whatever it was, you had to be screened for whether you had unconscious racism, that one?
Yeah, it was this unconscious bias test that they worked out that people took online on the internet. And from these results, they, you know, oh my God, you know, all white people are racist. But if you actually, you can still take this test online and you see if you agree with me, but I mean, it's, to me, it was apparent immediately why they got the results they did, because you go into the test knowing what the purpose is. It's not a blind test, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
you know, it's about race. And then the way they present the questions, what I found myself doing right off the bat was the questions where what they would do is they record, if you pause on a question, they say that indicates that you don't want it, you know, like all black people are good. If you pause on that question, they say that indicates a bias. You don't want to say that. But the thing is, what I found myself doing is when I would see the question like that, I would automatically pause an extra second to ensure I was not, you know what I mean? That I wasn't picking the racist answer.
Well, there wasn't actually a question like that, though, was there?
It's close. It's close. Some of the questions are very close to that. You'd have to take it yourself. But, I mean, see what you think. Mm-hmm. But since then, people with a lot better education than me have debunked this thing for a wide variety of reasons. The functionality, the methodology, the... You know,
My sense is that we're so far with the rhetoric now. It's like Orwell, you know, 2 and 2 plus 5. It's like it may be becoming overt with the transgender thing, that, you know, the brainwashing is attempting to just completely divorce our cognitive faculties from our perceptual faculties, so that we start believing things we can see aren't true. But I feel as though actually it's just something that's becoming really visible and manifest now, like a cancer that's finally, you know, breaking out in symptoms that goes way further back, and that we're already so far removed from a really lucid kind of cognitive capacity that my tendency is want to throw out the baby and the bathwater with this, as far as, you know, as far as putting any trust or faith in any sort of ideology, whether it's left or right or progressive or, you know, I just feel as though we've been so thoroughly divorced from just a lived direct interaction. And I use this example a lot, but I'll just use it briefly. Like I work in a thrift store, and we, it does involve, like, I've become kind of quite sympathetic to, well, let's say I've just become sympathetic to the condition of the poor and the hungry and the needy and the homeless and the traumatized. And so I'm becoming involved with that and trying to be helpful in that way. But so one could loosely superimpose onto that a leftist ideology, but I wouldn't do that. Like, I feel as though there are just some basic human truths that we need to just live and experience in order to recognize the value of and practice them, rather than referring to some sort of ideological template. You see what I mean by making that distinction?
I absolutely agree with you. I absolutely agree with you. I mean, I've always been a bit of an odd duck. I mean, I would be placed on the left spectrum because, you know, probably the majority of my ideas would fall on ideas they say are that. But, you know, I've never found it, I've always found it unhelpful that people feel they need to adopt one ideology or the other wholesale and not simply have their own opinions, which may fall all over it. And yeah, you know, like it's you're being told that you need to choose a camp.
Yeah.
And if you don't, one will be chosen for you by default.
Yeah.
I'd agree with that. I mean,
You know, I never thought I'd ever say this in my life. I mean, first off, I have a very young child, preschool. Never in my life did I ever think I'd be a homeschool type person. You know, and you know, like Doug Ford, when he got elected in Ontario, he's talking about maybe defunding parts of the university until they just knock off this ideological indoctrination. And I, you know, for sure, I never thought I'd ever even vaguely agree with a statement like that. But I mean, I don't see a way out of it. These institutions that we pay for are literally churning out ideological soldiers. And, you know, I mean, A, God knows how many actual good ideas we're missing, because if you try to express anything outside of this ideology in the universities, you get stomped down. And, I mean, these kids have a frightening lack of actual knowledge about anything, which makes them very susceptible to the ideology. But I asked a kid, he was graduating in political science, I shit thee not, to put the following in order. Rome, Egypt, Greece. Couldn't do it.
What was he learning?
Well, he could go on at length about intersectionality and the blah, 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 blah. You know?
Right.
But no, you know, like, so literally they aren't, and they, you know, they'll come out and say it. If you read, you know, you read some of Butler's stuff, some of the stuff coming out of these faculties or whatever, disciplines, it says it quite openly that the idea here is to confuse people. The idea is to deny the because facts are just a tool of the oppressive class.
Right.
Logic, reason, tools of the oppressive class. Oh, Lord. So it's hard to see a way forward. I mean, it's really hard. I think, you know, the next 10 years are going to look like the Reagan 80s in North America. They have made left-wing politics, or whatever you want to call it, so distasteful that the left, you know, the right wing is guaranteed power for quite some time.
Yeah, and it may be that the right wing, I mean, God, I don't want to fall in the trap of even talking about right and left now, but...
Sure.
But like, as like a good cop, bad cop thing, I suppose.
Well, exactly. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
So, and right now, the bad cop's looking like the good cop. It's so freaking confusing. But what I was trying to get to is my feeling is that we are being coerced and tricked and corralled into opening the door for a much more openly controlling or totalitarian kind of regime, and the part of that presumably would be that wolf in sheep's clothing, really, that this is the Fabian symbol, that we're being shown the thin end of the wedge, so it looks pretty good. It looks like this will go in nice and easy. this will straighten things out, you know. This will restabilize society.
Mm-hmm.
But once we actually let it in, then it'll be a very quick process whereby we're suddenly, almost suddenly, you know, hit with the thick end of the wedge, and we just realize how much we've gone along with, how much we've become complicit with in terms of just trying to maintain order and stabilize our society.
Sure. Well, I mean, like I said, the only, well, I don't know if I call it a solution here, but the only thing we can do really from my point of view is people on the left have to speak about this very publicly and be willing to take the inevitable hit on it. Because coming from the right, it has to come from left, and it has to come from, unfortunately, people with solid left-wing credentials, because otherwise, you know, all just all right.
So what, someone like Noam Chomsky, you mean?
I mean, I don't know. I don't know what actually counts as it's hard to say. It's hard to say. So I don't know. I mean, I have the peacekeeping in my background and the obviously and well-documented work I've done on the streets trying to protect people's rights in the Quebec student strike. So it's a little hard to say I'm a right-wing whatever. Although it's, you know, it doesn't stop people, but...
Well, but that taint of being a right-wing whatever, to some degree or another, it's going to be losing its power. It's like the black communities using the word nigger. I mean, that was part of the thing, was like, hey, if we use that word, it's going to lose some of its derogatory force. Well, I certainly not going to go around identifying as right wing. I don't want to identify as anything, never mind a political affiliation, but well, maybe a man with testicles. I don't mind going on a limb there. But as far as you being, if someone says you're right wing, I mean, it would be annoying. If they say I'm right wing, it'd be annoying, right? Because who wants to be pigeonholed? But it's becoming less and less of an actual slander, because it's becoming, because the left wing supposedly are becoming more and more overtly authoritarian, more and more reactive, yeah, more and more oppressive, more and more intolerant, and so on. So that as they're losing credibility, the right wing is gaining credibility, which is, as we're saying, is not a good thing. It's just a thing, right? But sure. But then, so then, I mean,
well, from the perspective of the actual power structure, which doesn't give a fuck about left, right, or any other goddamn thing.
Yeah.
It's perfect.
Yeah.
Right? Every time I see, like the soldiers of Odin or the Mute or whatever, and the Antifa brawling in the streets, what am I really looking at? I'm looking at two groups of fucked up poor people who are scared and scrapping each other.
Right.
Yeah. You know? And who's benefiting from all of this? It keeps us in this pendulum swing left-right election cycle. It completely has distracted people from what's actually going on around them, none of which is good. I mean, in terms of the left-right paradigm, I think one of the more interesting things in the last while has been Donald Trump's election, like it or not.
Mm-hmm.
Because whatever the fuck that freak is, he's not part of the plan. He ain't part of the game. And you can tell that because both sides of the game are attacking him viciously. Now, I'm not advocating for the guy. I'm just stating the obvious. When you got Michelle Obama going on tour with fucking George W. Bush, smiling and holding hands, that's got to tell you something.
Well, but if Trump got elected, so he's part of the game to that extent. So, I mean,
why is he though? Because nobody saw that fucker coming.
No, people did. People did.
A very, very few. Like when he first entered the race.
well, I mean that's the impression we've been given, but. Yeah. I was talking to Leatham and Jonathan Leatham, the author, and he said that Adam Curtis, who's a documentarian in Britain,
I know Curtis, yeah.
Oh, you know Curtis. He predicted that Trump would get elected. Now you could say, oh well, Curtis is just super smart, but I don't think that Curtis is smarter than these high level intelligence think tank people and so on and so forth, the Bilderbergs or wherever we want to go. Like, I think if someone like Curtis could foresee Trump getting elected, then there's a good chance that a whole bunch of...
What was the reason he gave? But it might be, it could be a very fucked up rejection of the game. Because there are a fuckload of people that voted for Trump that didn't admit to it the next day.
Yeah, I know. Well, my guess would be that it has to do with this whole thing about populism now. So, like, there's a growing demographic of people, who are fed up with the same old shit, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe even some people who voted for Obama and actually, you know, fell yeah. for that whole con that somehow that was going to be a game changer, right? So mm-hmm. even there, you got, I mean, that's how I see something like Obama, where they build up all this hope, and you just know, if you've studied parapolitics or just paid any attention at all, you know it's all a big frickin' hoax, and it's not going to make the least bit of difference, because it never does. But it is effective for generating more disillusionment, increased disillusionment with the whole system and so on. And I think that obviously, well, not obviously, but the appeal of Trump, a large part of it was that, same with Brexit. Yeah. People are disillusioned with yeah. the same old kind of ideological program. So that is something mm-hmm. that, on the one hand, you could say would take some people by surprise, even high-level people like Hillary Clinton. But on the other hand, you could also see that more long-term planners like Fabian Societies or whoever would be able to anticipate that and even to some extent, you know, direct it, like, okay.
Well, I mean, there's nobody, no matter how smart or how much money you've got, there's nobody sees everything coming, because humans are fuck-ass sure, complex sure. creatures. I don't know. It just, the reaction of the actual power structure in the United States to Trump's election is what tells me that he maybe wasn't part of the game plan. The U.S. was driving toward war with the Russian Federation.
Right.
He interrupted that. I mean, I'll tell you, you know, like, and again, I'm not defending this guy. I mean, he's a fucking rich as shit little dad, you know, like he's a rich boy, worthless human. But in my lifetime, he's the first U.S. president not to start a war in his first term. I don't know what the fuck Mike Pompeo said to Kim Jong-un. You know, the Korean tensions for the first time in 50 years are demounting. He just actually pulled U.S. troops out of Syria. It's mm-hmm. confusing.
It is confusing, yeah. Well, what if, and we're just spitballing now at this point, but what if there were interests in creating a civil war in the U.S.? Because he's great for that, right?
Well, I mean, you were headed that way anyway.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like once you get the kind of wealth distribution they got down there and the complete lack of services you know, you got whole cities hollowing out like fucking Detroit, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know. I don't know. Again, what I'm looking at is the reaction of the actual power structure down there, which is centered around the military and intelligence complex. And they have reacted in a very strong negative fashion to him. So I don't know. Now, whatever he is, what put him there, I would agree, is the same thing that got you to Brexit. It's a, you know, a media savvy and fairly, in comparison, fairly well-informed public, understanding that this is a shell game and mm-hmm. that we need to be beyond it. Identity politics could be a reaction to that. It's hard to say. Beyond a certain level, I can't figure out what they're doing. But again, I very strongly say that what we need to do, if we're going to forestall some kind of huge string to the right, and if we can, you know, have a politics again that does talk about inclusion, that does talk about human values, basic right and wrong human values, without all of this ideological baggage. Because until we get there, the only conversation really is, as you say, on the right. And people in the center and the soft left are heading that way. So politically, we're looking at a conservative government.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I've always tried to stay out of politics, and partly because I grew up in that kind of environment. Like, my family were very involved in politics, and I just saw the hypocrisy of it pretty clearly even when I was young. But certainly looking back now, I realize how deep the hypocrisy went. And I mean the combined hypocrisy of their interest in politics with the hypocrisy of the politics that they were interested in. I mean, the hypocrisy at the core of British politics, and I would say world politics. And so I, you know, I, but it's getting so, it's encroaching so much on our lives now with identity politics that it's impossible to stay out of politics and have a conversation that's relevant, really. So sure. Yeah, you and I were, you know, we hooked up to talk about stuff. I mean, the transgender thing was the shared interest, and obviously that's a deeply political thing area. But in terms of trying to work out what's going on in the world and fix it, that's not something I have any illusions about. I just feel as though that if two people can connect and actually just looking at it as a problem, a human problem, like we're living in a world and we can't understand what the hell is going on. And that's obviously, that's a very vital experience to be having. And more people are having that, like this confusion over actually sure. What we're being told to believe and what we're being told is true and so on. That in itself is very destabilizing. I think, for me, I think one of the traps is feeling that we've got to do something about it more than just try and make sense of it. And even that seems possibly too ambitious. I don't know. I mean, we all come at this from different angles, don't we?
Well, I mean, yeah. I come out of the third trailer from the left in Alberta. I was raised by a single mother on Alberta welfare. Mm-hmm. So she was usually one step ahead of the sheriff. So I know a lot about economic insecurity. You know, and I know a lot about how the whims of you know, society's politics can be horribly detrimental to the actual most vulnerable in our society, which generally are, that's decided by economic class, not by the color of your skin. Mm-hmm. So yeah, when I see something that, I mean, I come from a military background. So when I see something that I feel is threatening, I like to fix it, understand it, and then try and kill it. So that would be my take on identity politics. I already am, obviously, and I will continue to speak as eloquently and as forcefully as I can against this. And hopefully, you know, even if it changes 5 or 10 minds or causes, you know, a few people to sit back and reconsider the utility of this, then that's useful to me. I think, you know, I look at this as long game. I think this will take a decade or more to see the end of the effects of, for sure.
I hear a voice that's not my own that tells me to jump into the sea. I'm tired of listening to these words. I know they aren't meant for me. I know they aren't meant for me. I won't listen anymore. I won't listen anymore.
That is the end of my conversation with William Wright. You can find out more about Bill at his website, Stormhaven Media, as linked in the show notes. Thanks to my donators, Samuel Thomas Timu, Eric, Nicholas, John, Ryan, Kimberly, and Stephen. Thanks to those who've already bought Vice of Kings, which is now available. If you'd like to support me that way, let's see if we can get that book up the charts, so to speak. Generate a little more interest and attention. be the best way to do it if you have ordered it, and once you've read it, if you would like to review it, Amazon. But that's a good way to get it up the ranks, I think. Also, if you want to participate in the ongoing YouTube meet, I think I will be doing it this Saturday. I haven't come up with a theme yet, but just check it out on YouTube via my channel on Saturday morning, 11 a.m. Pacific Standard Time. Next week I'm talking to Gib Strange. These words, these words are yours. From when you are born, everything you are told becomes you without your choice. Some point they become the family of one that speaks with only